I don't know if any of you watch much Christian television. Trinity Broadcasting, which is TBN. And he's on other ones, too. I think he's on Daystar. But there's a gentleman and has a large church in Dallas, Texas, called Gateway Church. His name is Robert Morris. Good teacher, good pastor and teacher. And he's written a lot of books. One of the books that he wrote before this one was just called How to Live a Blessed Life. And he took all the money from that book, the proceeds, and of course gave it to the church and to the ministry. But then he wrote this one not long ago. Judy and I have been using it for our devotional time together. And in hopes I'm going to try with the information that I glean from this, because it's all biblical, to try to put together a series. And he says, beyond blessed is God's perfect plan to overcome all financial stress. And I think even people that's got a lot of money have financial stress. Financial stress is, comes in all different ways. But what, and when we were at this particular part the other day, and he was touching on the parable in Luke 16. And he uses some analogies to really make think about your own life, because you are the CEO of your own life. You need to think about that, but you're in charge of your own life. You are the chief operating officer of your life. And he says, I don't know about you, but knowing that my stewardship is being examined from heaven makes me want to examine myself. After all, good managers constantly evaluate the health of their own enterprise. So our spiritual life and our financial life, God knows what we need when we need it. John Wesley, before he became a priest, although he was raised in a Christian home, his dad was a pastor, and his mother was also teacher of the gospel. So before John Wesley became a priest, and then later on, as we know, was the founder of Methodism, he was a teacher at Oxford University back in the 1700s. And when he began his career, he was paid 30 pounds a year. A pound in English money is like our dollar, although the pound equal to the dollar is usually, say, $2.50 to our $1. But 30 pounds a year is a lot of money in those days back in the 1700s. And his living expenses were 28 pounds. So he gave away the other 2 pounds. The next year his income doubled, but he managed to live on 28 pounds, and he gave away 32 pounds. And then the third year, he earned 90 pounds and he lived on 28 and he gave away 62 pounds. The fourth year, he earned 120 pounds. He lived on 28 pounds and he gave away the 92 pounds. One year, his income was a little over 1,400 pounds and he lived on 30 pounds and he gave away nearly all of the 1,400 pounds. So what would all that mean? Why would John Wesley do all that? He felt with increasing income, what should not rise is our standard of Christian living, but our standard of Christian giving. Increasing the standard of giving allows us to experience a lot of the benefits of what God has blessed us with. What a great Christian man, and what a great lesson that he can teach us. In the same lesson, which was found in the parable today in Luke chapter 16, which was teaching us about the same things. So think about this. In Luke chapter 16, it talked about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and they were religious peoples of the day, but they also were pretty much what we call wealthy. And there they are, standing to the side, listening and watching as Jesus was preaching and teaching, which was the custom of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they were intently listening to his story. And probably there were more than just the 12 disciples, because there was probably a larger number of followers that gathered around to listen to Jesus preach. We know that the 12 official disciples is what we looked at, but there was others that was interesting on what he was teaching and preaching, and they followed him around. So a large number of followers gathered around Jesus. And he started telling them about a steward who handled the business affairs of a wealthy man. But the steward had squandered his master's money. He was reckless. He was wasteful. And if you look at this story and you follow another story about a reckless young man who, right in the previous chapter in Luke, was about the prodigal son. So there was a reckless young man who squandered his father's wealth. But in this story, the reckless young man does not come to his senses in time, and he is fired from his job. Then he does something so shrewd and so convincing. He's cleaning out his desk, so to speak, clearing out all the things that was there. He called all his master's debtors, to those who had outstanding accounts, and he cut those debts in half. You owe 800 gallons, cut it to 400 gallons. Got 1,000 bushels of wheat that you owe? No, just give me a check for half of that. He forgives the debts that are not his to forget or forgive. Anybody he does, he gains friends in the process. Strangely enough, as a result, his master commends him. And you think, what in the world would the guy commend him for that for? He was commending him because he was shrewd. So what's the point that Jesus is trying to make about that particular parable? There's a couple points that I want to just to take a look at. And I think the first thing, he explains the wise use of worldly wealth. Do you know that one of the wisest things that you can do with your money is give it away? Oh, no, I got to give away. Yeah, the wisest thing you can do is give it away. It's not the only thing, but it's one of the wisest things. And you think, wait a minute, preacher, why? Because this may sound a little bit strange. Gaining friends through generous gifts means you will be welcome into eternal dwellings. In a world where we live in, and in a world, if you give here, you'll be welcome there. It's almost like trying to buy your way into the kingdom. And we always get this wrong in the church. We come up with these reasons why we should give. I love it for years and years and years. You don't hear it too much anymore. But when I was just getting involved in the church and as a lay person, there was always stewardship campaigns. The conference was always coming up with these ways of raising money to make the church more prosperous. So to speak, they said, well, we got to use the business approach. We give because we need 5% more money than we needed last year. Then we try flattery. Well, you have the means, and if you give only this amount, it won't hurt. And we try to put people on guilt trips in them years and say like something like, well, you're wealthier than the 95% of the people in the world's population. And then we would try to use greed. You'll get back more than you gave. I find it interesting, like Bob Morris isn't one of them, but some of the preachers and the teachers, they preach a good message, but then they get down to the end of their message, good teaching, and they'll say something like, well, God gave me 3,000 miracles this morning, and if you send a $58 seed, you know, you could be one of these 3,000 miracles. Get off of your couch and go to the phone and before they're all gone. No, that's not the way it works. I think God will deal with those preachers eventually. But you get back more than you gave, is what they say. We give for a reason. Except the right reason sometimes is not the reason that we give. Giving because Christ supremely gave. giving, because we are not truly human until we become a giver. Giving to keep grace alive within us. Giving because it reflects the nature of God who gives everything. If you ever wonder, what did he give to me? Hold your breath for 15 seconds. Can't do it. That's the gift of life, the gift of breath. God gives us so many things, but he has given us the gift of life. And then he's given us the gift of life for eternity. He sent his son into the world to pay that price so that we can come to eternity. Those are the reasons that we should give. But Jesus had a very strange way of making this point in this particular parable. The dishonest steward gains friends by cooking the books. He masters them and controls them. He commends him for his dishonesty. Now I scratch my head. Why is he commending him for being dishonesty? Jesus didn't even call it dishonest. He called it shrewd. And then the story ends. And Jesus used this unethical person to make a religious point. People in this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than they are with people of light. People of light is, of course, Christians. And you think, okay, well, yeah, I kind of get that point, preacher, but people can be pretty ruthless in their business dealings. I know about that. Taking care of the bottom line, that's the most important things, but why are we that way? Why do we think about it's only the bottom line that we care about? After all, we're people of light. We're not people of the world. You know, the people of darkness. Are we to take as our model a careless man who was dishonest to the core? Why would that even be in the Bible? Why would be Jesus talking about something like that? The answer is this, yes, but not because he's a scoundrel. He's our model because he used his resources. It's not his actions that Jesus commends. It's simply that he acted. Oh, yeah, it's not his selfishness or different things that Jesus is commending him for, but his assertiveness. And sometimes we Christians don't have the same tenacity towards the thing of God. I'll tell you this, Jesus said, use worldly wealth to gain earthly friends so that the internal dwellings you will find your heavenly home. So the crooked steward acted to ensure his own livelihood. And on the other hand, not to increase our standard of living. We are to increase our standard of giving. But why? Because in the end, when all the money is gone, how we have used our resources here will determine our welcome up there. And then the other thing to think about, the point that Jesus was trying to make, was trustworthiness. It's measured by character. Would you trust your money with somebody of ill repute, so to speak, or wasn't trustworthy? And I think Jesus speaks for all of us when he says, the person who can be trusted with very little can be trusted with much. Watch how someone handles the little things in your life, and then you'll know how they handle the bigger things. We are in a world now where there's a lot of big health care organizations all around the country. They become real big, like Capital Health Plan and some of the others. One of the health plans in Georgia, the guy that runs the health plan was telling a story. And he was telling the story where a patient that was in the hospital, and he knocked over a cup of water off his nightstand, and it spilled on the floor beside the bed. And the patient was afraid that he might slip on the water when he got out of bed to go to the bathroom. So he pushed the little button, and nurse's aide came and asked if they would mop it up. Now, the patient didn't know it, but the hospital policy... I love hospital policy. The hospital policy said that small spills were the responsibility of the nurse's aide, while the large spills would be mopped up by the housekeeping staff in the hospital. So the nurse's aide decided that the spill was a large one. "I'll call the housekeeping department," she said. And the housekeeper arrived and declared that the spill was a small one. And then they started arguing. "It's not my responsibility. It's a large puddle. It's not a small puddle. It's not my responsibility." And they go, blah, 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 blah. Well, finally, the patient, after listening to this for a long time, he reached over and he grabbed the whole pitcher of water off his nightstand and he spilled it on the floor. And he said, "Now, is that a big enough puddle for you to decide to clean it up?" And then the argument was over. Well, faith won little, faith won much. That's the principle. That's the acid test for character. I love what J.C. Watt used to say about character. Character is something that you do when nobody's watching. All events were honest, and it needed are very little things. All moments where fidelity is required are little. All temptations take on another thing. All temptations to drink alcohol or whatever are little. All money has been entrusted is little compared to true riches, which that's what I like to paraphrase what the Apostle Paul said in Romans 7, that if we only had this life to look forward to, we'd all be a sorry bunch of puppies. But praise be to God, because of the death, the burial, and the resurrection, and the promised coming of Jesus again, we have eternal life to look forward to. So I want to share with you, if you have not been trustworthy with your worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches? That's the question for you and I that Jesus tells us in a lot of these parables. All the resources that have been placed in our care here on earth are but small tests. In this world you have trials and tribulations, you have tests, but fear not, I've overcome the world. Because he wants well-trained saints in heaven. So take heart. You're going to be in basic training until he either comes for us or we go home to be with him. Have you been entrusted with little things? Have you been entrusted with big things and you know what they are? Have you been entrusted with good character? Have you been found trustworthy in your life? Are you responsible for all the earthly riches that you have? Your worldly wealth, use it graciously, responsibly, with fidelity. Your future, your true future, depends upon it. And one other thing. Our service must be singular. Jesus said, in a way, we cannot serve both God and money. Some translations say mammon. The family and the friends and the resources that we've been entrusted with are only temporary because God is eternal. So don't make the mistake of putting your trust in worldly wealth. I've been guilty of that. I will not be here forever, and you won't either, so don't devote yourself to money, basically, is what it's saying. There is no anchor in it. It shifts like the sand, and it cannot, it's like a carrot before the horse and the noose around the neck. Money can be good, money can be bad. It's not that money is bad. Jesus said, when they were talking about the root of all evil, it's not the money that's the root of all evil, it's our way that we take care of money and resources. Things that happen in our life, every time you lend somebody money, especially a friend or a relative, you damage their memory. Think about that. When a person said, "It's not the money, it's the principle of the thing," you can bet your bottom dollar it's about the money. Before borrowing money from a friend, decide which you need more, the friend or the money. Money, it doesn't fill a vacuum, it creates one. So if you want to know what God thinks of money, just look at the people that he gave it to. You can't get rid of poverty by giving people money. We've been trying to do that in this country ever since the Great Society, and starting in the 30s and with Lyndon Johnson's in the early 60s. Billy Graham said it all. This is a quote from Billy Graham. When wealth is lost, nothing is lost. When health is lost, something is lost. When character is lost, all is lost. I love preacher stories, rabbi stories. This is a story about a rabbi, and I'll close with this. One day, certain old rich man, miserable disposition as he was, came and he visited the rabbi. And after a lengthy conversation, the rabbi took the rich man by the hand and he led him over to the window. He said, "Look out there. What do you see?" "I see people, women and children walking around out there, Rabbi." Again, the rabbi took him by the hand and he led him over to a mirror. He said, "What do you see now?" He said, "I see myself." The rabbi said, "Yeah. Behold, in the window there is glass, and in the mirror there is glass. But you know what the difference is? The glass of the mirror is covered with a little thin coat of silver. And no sooner is the silver added than you cease to see others, and you see only yourself." I like that. Jimmy Dean wrote it, and I think I shared it with you before. It's a little poem that he sang, basically, and it's called "The Man in the Glass." Who is your best friend? You look in the mirror. And it's how you treat your best friend that allows you to handle things in life. If you never heard it, maybe I'll make a copy of it for you and pass it out, because it is really heart-wrenching and it sums it all up. So, if I would sum up this parable in Luke 16 and the lessons that Jesus is trying to teach us, I would put it this way. We live in a temporary world that has eternal consequences. So use wealth wisely, be faithful with little things, and be devoted only to God.